Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. On an almost daily basis, we hear about American soldiers killed or wounded fighting in Afghanistan and in Iraq. No less important, but sometimes less noticed, are the psychological, emotional effects of the combat experience, what that can mean for soldiers, and also what that can mean for their families. In this hour of focus, we'll be taking a look at the emotional toll that military service can take on both soldiers and their families. And our guest for the program is Shelley McDermid. She is professor of family studies at Purdue University. She is also the co-director of the Military Family Research Institute that assists the Office of Military Community and Family Policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense in studying and developing policies that relate to the quality of life for military members and their families. We'll be talking this morning in part about this whole issue, about combat stress, about what it is, about what it means, what that means for soldiers, their families, and how it is that the Department of Defense, particularly, is trying to respond to that need. And we'll be talking about the report of a task force that has just recently been issued, and it was a task force that she co-chaired, a task force on mental health of the Department of Defense. The report was just come out last month in June. So as we talk this morning with Dr. McDermid, you certainly should feel free to be a part of the conversation, people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that they just try to be brief in their comments and questions, and the only reason we ask that is just to keep things moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So either way, whether you're here where we are, Champaign-Urbana, or anywhere else that signal will travel, your comments and questions certainly are welcome. Professor McDermid, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Perhaps one good way for us to start would be for me to ask you to talk a little bit about this task force on mental health that of the Department of Defense that you were involved in and that issued this recent report, and then perhaps we can talk a little bit specifically about what's in the report. Maybe just to start off, though, tell us how it is that this task force came to be.
The task force was created by legislation. Barbara Boxer and others sponsored legislation that required the Department of Defense to appoint a task force of 14 members to examine the system for supporting the mental health of service members and their families provided by the Department of Defense, and gave the task force a year to do its work. We were appointed early in the summer of 2006, and of course at that time we were kind of the only game in town dealing with mental health, and just as we finished our work in June, we were one of a thundering herd of commissions and work groups and task forces. But we had the advantage of enough time to be able to travel around to installations both in the U.S. and around the world to do site visits, and we also had a little bit more time to deliberate than some of the other groups have had. It turns out there's pretty good consensus among many of the recommendations, so I think that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, combat stress is not new. We know that this has been a factor probably as long as human beings have been fighting wars. We perhaps have had different ways of talking about it. We have had different names for it. Maybe even we're now to the point where we recognize that it's perhaps a more significant and more pervasive than we have in the past. But you can't say that it's something we have just discovered. Having said all that, do you think that it is something that, say, before the Iraq war, before the last few years, was it something that we were giving adequate attention to? Or was it something that perhaps we were under, we're not paying enough attention to?
One of the things I've learned in the time that I've been working with the military is that knowledge tends to leap forward combat by combat. And you're absolutely right that there's been recognition of combat stress and post-traumatic stress and stress-related disorders for a long time. It has been a long time, though, since the United States has been involved in a combat situation like this one, where it's protracted, where it's dangerous, there's widespread exposure to trauma, and enormous numbers of military members are being deployed many, multiple times. That's quite different from the first Gulf War and many of the regional conflicts that the United States has been involved with over the last decade or so. It's also the case that we continue to learn about mental health and treatments and new strategies for dealing with it. So you're right, it's not new, but this conflict has provided both the challenge and the opportunity of spurring development of new ways to deal with combat stress, to prevent it, to treat it. It's also important to understand that everybody who enters the military enters with some degree of prior exposure to trauma. We don't just experience trauma in military life. People in their lives are the victims of crime, or something has happened at their home that is traumatic. So everybody comes in with a certain amount of prior experience, and that can pose a risk factor for if they experience serious trauma as a function of combat.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is changed by experiencing combat. Combat stress is a normal reaction to a traumatic circumstance. The goal is to try to make sure that everyone recovers from that combat stress without it moving to a point at which we would consider it a disorder, where it's interfering with daily life for a prolonged period of time and people have trouble getting past it. So it's part of a continuum.
Hmm.
And there are some exciting, I think, research efforts underway by clinicians around the country and all kinds of medical folks to try to understand even very measurable physiological changes that happen to people as a function of exposure to trauma, whether or not they're in the military. So I'm hopeful that one of the positive outcomes of this conflict might be that we learn new things about treating trauma in both the civilian and the military population.
You know, there certainly has been a lot of criticism of the healthcare system for the military that's there to take care of soldiers who are wounded in combat, both their short-term and their long-term needs. And I think that also there's been some criticism about just how well the system responds to people who have emotional trauma. And it's not the case that there was no system before, but I think that the point is that it was the system that was there in place was a peacetime system. One could raise the questions about whether it was even adequate to the peacetime needs of the military, but it certainly wasn't adequate to the wartime needs. And it seemed that there was a significant lag in trying to for the system to try to gear up to address the increased needs that come with the fact that here we had significant numbers of people in combat, and as you say, people who were spending a long time in theater and people who were having to go back again and again because of the continued need for troops. How well now do you think that the military healthcare system has done? Is it now really up to speed, or do you think that even now, several years into this conflict, it's still adjusting to the increased need?
I think the conclusion of the task force is that considerable adjustments still need to be made. My recollection of the period in the 1990s when the military was downsized was that we were planning for the likelihood that the U.S. military would be fighting small-scale regional conflicts. There wasn't a lot of talk about a large-scale, protracted, widespread war. And so you're right that the planning that was done during that time didn't seem to be a very good fit for the conflict in which we've found ourselves. There are good things that people have been trying to do. The military has implemented a variety of systems that I think are really positive steps. It's also true, though, that they're spread so thin. I mean, simply geographically, when you look at the mental health system, when we're at war, the mental health system has to serve not only the people at home, but also the people in Iraq and Kuwait and Afghanistan and other places. And the number of people to do that doesn't increase as much as the geography increases. So that alone makes for some unfortunate arithmetic in terms of trying to meet mental health needs.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that everybody is changed by the experience of combat. So there's no one that comes through this completely unscathed and untouched. And at the same time, you also say that the kinds of psychological impact, it's going to be a continuum. And everyone will not be affected in the same way. And there will some people who are more profoundly affected than others. So then there'll be perhaps a range of what people need, a range in what that means for their lives, perhaps a range in what that means for people being able to get on with their lives. Is there, though, some way to put a number on how many people will experience significant after effects of combat, and then for how many of those people it's going to be serious enough so that it will get in the way of them returning to life?
I think I can give you some numbers, but let me say one thing first, mm-hmm. which is that it's important not to lose sight of the fact that for many service members, deployment is a challenging experience in a good way as well as a bad way. And I know that in what we read in the newspapers here and the stories that we see on television about the war, that sounds like it must be nonsense. But I've had many military members tell me with great conviction that to serve their country at a time when they are needed is a very meaningful experience. And it can be very frustrating to spend years and years and years training to do a job that you never get to do. So people feel tested by deployment and by combat. And if they survive it, both mentally and physically, many of them feel as though they have survived a challenge and they're that much stronger going forward. So I wouldn't want people to think that deployment is a universally negative experience, or that service members didn't sign up voluntarily to go into combat. They did, and many of them serve out of a sense of calling to their country. Before I did much work with the military, I think I would have been skeptical when someone explained that to me, but I've now spent several years talking with folks and spending time with them and being in settings where they're talking about their experiences, and I believe it. Now, in terms of exposure to trauma and percentages, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, I believe it's the case that about 9% of people in the civilian population, in the population as a whole, are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder at any given time, and that deployment bumps that up, if I'm remembering correctly, about 7%. So about 16% of folks show symptoms that are severe enough that they would pass an initial screen for PTSD. About one-third of the folks coming back from Iraq express an interest in seeing a mental health provider or a concern about a mental health issue. Most of those turn out to be short-term, not diagnosable, and not PTSD.
One of the things that I think that we know about the population at large is that it is very difficult for people to admit that they're having mental health issues and to seek help. And this is not, we're just talking about, not talking about people who are in the military or whatever's going on have tested it with combat. I mean, it's just general, the stresses of daily life. It's highly stigmatized, and it's very difficult to admit that you're having emotional problems and go for help. So this is something that we know generally exists. One of the things that we have heard a lot about is, and this is, I think, largely been anecdotal, but significant enough to be worried about, that is people in the military saying what they've done, that is that they felt that they were having problems, and essentially that their superiors basically told them to just shut up and to suck it up and to get on with doing their jobs, and that that there are people who have actually been punished for saying that they felt that they had problems, and is that something that you can speak to?
I can speak to it to some extent. There is more than anecdotal data. I think there are pretty good empirical data that service members believe that if they admit to mental health concerns, or if others know about their concerns, they will be treated differently. It is also the case that some leaders are not very supportive of members receiving mental health treatment and behave in ways that make their service members feel like they can't get the treatment they need. It's definitely an issue. There are a few things to think about. One of the challenges is that commanders have a lot of demands on them right now, and it's difficult enough to prepare for deployment without losing people from your unit all the time for them to go off and get treatment. So for some commanders, it's a logistical issue that is an annoyance that they don't really want to deal with, even if it's not stigma. It's just the logistics of having people coming and going. But there are individuals who do have negative attitudes about mental health problems, and they don't really believe it, or they have the same sorts of misapprehensions that I think many people in the civilian population have. Mental health problems in many instances can be prevented, they can be treated, and they can be fixed. I don't think people typically think that way. I think our own stereotype is that if you have a mental illness, you're mentally ill for all time. And we have to challenge that. We also have to challenge the way that we think about mental health and think about it more from a public health perspective. We teach even very young children about first aid, which deals with physical and medical issues. How much do we teach very young people about mental health issues? How much do we teach them about anxiety or depression or signs of concern that someone might be suicidal? So part of the challenge that the military faces is that they need to make a transition, at least so far as the task force is concerned, they need to make a transition to a more public health model of dealing with mental health. Whenever we think it's important to treat people about some medical or physical issue, why aren't we also treating them about some psychological or mental health issue?
I asked a question about what, if it was possible to say something about what the incidence of combat stress would be. And you said, first of all, well, as far as we know, that roughly about 9% of the population as a whole experiences some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, and the deployment put that's up to 16%. So that's a that's going to be a pretty significant number. And then you said about a third of the people come back, they express some interest in getting some kind of counseling or help with psychological issues. Now, I have no idea what kind of number of people we're talking here about here, but it seems to me, I'm sure that it is a very significant number. What are the counseling resources available like? And if we were really going to try to address that need, would we have to simply, in one sense, would we have to simply somehow go out and round up a whole lot more psychologists and counselors simply to have enough people so that the service people and their families can have somebody to sit down and talk with?
There's no question that more people are needed to do the work. In particular, the task force felt strongly that the number of uniformed mental health professionals needed to be increased, or at least the number of mental health professionals who have a strong familiarity with military life. People find it difficult to talk about deployment, and it's even more difficult if the person that you're sitting across from can't understand you speak. And it doesn't take long when you're talking with the military members to get lost in acronym language. If people had a little bit of familiarity, it would make that conversation much easier. So the bad news is that we do need more providers. They don't need to all be psychologists. There are a variety of folks in the mental health continuum who can be helpful to members, all the way from what in the military they call psych techs, through social workers, through therapists, through psychologists, all the way up to psychiatrists. More people are needed. There's a good news story, too, potentially, which is that the health insurance system in the military, and this is particularly relevant for Guard and Reserve members, relies on the TRICARE health system. TRICARE networks around the country include mental health providers, and military members are able to go to them. I wish there were more of them, and I wish more of them were accepting patients. But there's an untapped resource there in the sense that many of these local providers could train up a little bit more to be aware of new evidence-based treatment guidelines for PTSD and get themselves more familiar with military life. And if you're in communities where there have been a lot of folks deployed and coming back, that would be a very helpful thing to do, and it would go a long way toward helping to meet the unmet need.
Just, for a moment here, first of all, I should pause and reintroduce our guest. And then also we need to do an EAS test. Maybe we'll get that out of the way first. We are doing here our required monthly test of the emergency alert system. It'll just take a moment. This is only a test. And you're listening to Focus 580 here on AM 580. My name is David Inge. This is our morning talk program. And this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about military families and mental health. And our guest is Professor Shelley McDermott. She is speaking with us from the campus of Purdue University, where she is professor of family studies. She is also co-director of the Military Family Research Institute, which is based there at Purdue, that works with the Office of Military Community and Family Policy within the Office of the Secretary of Defense. They work in studying and developing policies that relate to the quality of life for military members and their families. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. You'd like to be part of the conversation, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I just wanted to pick up on and perhaps have you talk a little bit about. We've been talking about some of the challenges faced by the Department of Defense and the healthcare system that is there for regular military in assessing the needs of people who have been hurt, both people who have been physically wounded in combat and people who are dealing with emotional issues. There also, a lot of people who are serving there are people who are in National Guard and Reserve, and there the kind of care that it's available for them is different. And it seems that here the unmet need, sort of the gap between what's provided and what's available and the need there is perhaps even greater than it is for people who are in the regular military. Have I got that right?
I think that's true. And, of course, most of the military members in Illinois, from what I can determine, are members of the Guard and Reserve. The Guard and Reserve are organized a little differently. Guard members are supported through a state organization, whereas reservists are supported through regional organizations run by the reserves. I believe it's the case that both Indiana and Illinois are served by the 88th Regional Readiness Command, which is based in Minnesota. Guard and Reserve members have access to military treatment facilities at installations for a short period of time after they return from deployment, and then they would return to their employer-provided health insurance. They can also be served under the TRICARE system if they wish, and they have some access to resources at VA facilities, specifically vet centers that are located in many communities to do a variety of types of counseling. If you have noticed the string of panels they've had in Dewsbury over the last few months, they show the operation at a vet center where people are coming for counseling. I think one of the big challenges for Guard and Reserve members is the ability to follow up on problems that emerge during deployment or shortly after deployment, because when they come home and when they're deactivated, any sort of mental health treatment or transaction they've had during deployment, there's no way to carry it over to their next provider. So even if something serious had emerged during deployment, the only way that a future provider would know would be if the military member took action to let the provider know. The military, I think, has implemented a very good strategy of trying to figure out how members are doing following deployment. Everybody who returns completes a post-deployment health assessment, which includes both physical and mental health questions, as soon as they get back, and they do a reassessment at about between 90 and 180 days. The challenge is that when someone reports something at the reassessment, which is where we see the highest levels of mental health issues reported, there isn't a good mechanism to follow up with Guard and Reserve folks because they're deactivated soon after that time, and there's not a great mechanism in terms of staffing in the states or in the reserve regions to follow up. And I know that's something DOD is working on, but I think it's an uphill struggle.
We have a caller here, and I think we're getting another lined up to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Starting here in Urbana with someone on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm calling about this may not be the area of expertise of the guest, but I'd like to get a comment on counseling versus medication. I know that often both types of approaches are used. An observation I have is that a lot of people I knew, a surprising number of people I knew as a young adult, including myself, had seen counselors. You know, I think there's something about changing from, you know, the college student to the responsible adult that maybe causes stress. My observation is that people who ended up taking medication right away have ongoing issues today, and the people who didn't are, you know, pretty happy and generally okay and don't even mostly see a counselor anymore. And I just wonder if there's any research on this and whether the guest has any comments about this observation.
I'm not a clinician, so I want to be cautious about what I say, and you need to hear my remarks in that spirit. But the question you ask is one that I've had myself, because it's true that in our society and in the military as well, most people receive medications related to mental health from their primary care doc. So they go to their family practitioner and say something about an issue that they're dealing with, and most of the prescriptions are written there. And so I've been curious, and I was able to ask people on the task force who are researchers and psychiatrists and psychologists how they feel about that treatment modality and whether it makes sense. And what they told me is that there's not necessarily a reason to be concerned if a primary care physician prescribes for a psychological issue, and it can be dealt with very well that way, but that the medication doesn't necessarily help someone deal with the underlying matter. So very often it's a good idea, if you're on medication, to also go through therapy so that you can deal with the underlying mental health issue, and once the physiological expression of that settles down, you're ready to resume your normal life. And primary care physicians are unevenly prepared for dealing with mental health issues. This is certainly true in the military. I assume it's true in the civilian world. So medication alone may not be the right strategy. The caution in the pattern that you observe is that, of course, you don't really know for sure how serious someone's issue is.
Certainly.
May be that the people who got medication had something more serious, and so it's lingering, whereas the people who didn't rise to the level of needing medication, you know, seem to be doing well.
Well, just one more comment on that.
Sure.
Line. It seems that the ongoing thing generally is a depression later in life, you know, maybe 10 years after the person started, and periodic depressions, but very often it's a person who is having trouble with a medication that they've been taking for years and all of a sudden is finding side effects or finding that it's not working, so they're mm-hmm. in transition to a new medication. And by that mechanism alone, it looks to me like the problem may have been perpetuated. So I can't discount the point you're making. You don't know whose problems are more serious to begin with, but that if you take the medication for a problem that could be solved by counseling, you are inviting this problem later on, you know, years down the road, where you just have this problem that you're essentially dependent on a chemical, and that when that chemical abandons you, you're in trouble.
Certainly dealing with underlying issues is something that we need to do, and there are lots of examples of people self-medicating with alcohol and other kinds of drugs to try to avoid having to deal with what the really hard underlying matter is. We also know, though, that there are mental health conditions for which there is a physiological substrate.
Certainly.
And that medication can help with that. So we quickly get beyond my area of expertise, but I think your basic point is a really good one. If there's an underlying issue, you have to try to deal with that. Medication isn't going to make that go away. Medication may make it easier physiologically to deal with it, but if there's an underlying issue, medication's not going to make that go away.
Thank you.
All right, let's go on to the next caller here, and that would be someone over in Indiana, in Terre Haute, line number 4.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted two questions, I guess. One is, it's my sense, having been a Vietnam veteran, that everybody experiences some level of trauma related to combat, and that for some it's more severe than for others, and for some it might even result in violent kinds of responses. And so is that a worthy insight? And secondly, I've got some experience with DDES and DODS educational settings, where the welfare of families, not only those deployed, but children and spouses, is very effectively attended to. But we're also seeing a lessening of those programs in the military. And I wonder, again, if you've had any experience with the value of that setting to support families. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your call. I think your observation as a Vietnam veteran is very consistent with what people tell me today. Combat and brings trauma. And in fact, trauma can come from other circumstances too. There are a lot of military members who have worked on peacekeeping operations and also disaster recovery. And those things also bring traumatic experiences that it's hard for people to deal with. Many of those circumstances involve people dealing with bodies, for example, seeing dead bodies or seeing body parts. That is a very disturbing and traumatic experience. And for many people, it takes time to recover from that. So I think you're right on. It's hard for everybody. The aftermath may vary quite a bit, and hopefully we've got good tools getting better all the time for trying to deal with the challenges that people experience. The DODS and the DDoS systems that you mentioned are the military schools. The military actually runs, the U.S. military runs the largest school system in the country. They have schools primarily overseas, although not exclusively, particularly where there are very large installations in the U.S. that are located in pretty remote areas. They may run a complete school system on the installation. And you're correct that those schools pride themselves on doing a good job of supporting military members and their families. Children in those schools do pretty well in terms of test scores, and obviously the people working there have a pretty good familiarity with military life. It is a little bit of an unfair comparison to the civilian world, of course, because military members are not representative of the population as a whole. On average, they tend to be a little bit younger. Nobody in the military is unemployed. Everybody makes at least a subsistence living. So the children that are coming to those schools are already a population that is less at risk in some ways than folks in the civilian world, although, of course, they face the risk of their parents being deployed. I've also had folks tell me that one of the advantages of the military school system is that if the principal needs to see the parent, that's pretty easy to arrange with a call to a first sergeant or a commander. It is true, though, that the war is challenging everybody. And one of the sort of unspoken challenges or unseen challenges is that a huge proportion of the support structure in the military consists of people who are in military families. So the people who are early childhood educators, the people who are social workers, the people who are family readiness group leaders, and the people who are school teachers, many of them are spouses or parents of military members, and they also are feeling challenged by the deployments in their own families as well as the deployments of all of the families they serve. My sense is they're getting tired.
We have about 15 minutes left, actually maybe about 12 or 13 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I would like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last little bit. Shelley McDermott is professor of family studies at Purdue University. She is also the co-director of the Military Family Research Institute that's based there at Purdue. It does work for the Department of Defense looking at policies, studying and developing policies that relate to the quality of life for military members and their families. I also do want to mention, too, that she was the co-chair of a Department of Defense task force on mental health. And if you are interested in perhaps reading some more about this particular issue and what the Department of Defense is trying to do to address it, the task force released a report, a rather comprehensive one, that just came out in June, an Achievable Vision report of the Department of Defense Task Force on Mental Health, June 2007. It is available on the web, so if you have internet access and you would like to read it, I'm sure that you can take a look at it. And other questions, comments are certainly welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is here, back where we are in Champaign, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have something and something that I don't think most Americans know about. I wouldn't know about it except it happened to my son. He had one deployment as a reservist. He was stateside for that. And then he had a second deployment where he was sent to Afghanistan for a year. And when he came back, he had the test, the follow-up psychological and all of this that you were talking about. And then he, 3 months later, 4 months later, he had a follow-up call to check and see how he was doing and whatever. And as he was talking to the woman who was asking him these questions, he thought for sure he was talking to someone from Chicago because he thought he recognized the accent. And she admitted that, no, she wasn't calling from Chicago. She was calling from Toronto, Canada. And he was absolutely incensed that his military records and his information and all of this personal stuff that he had been telling her was outsourced to a foreign country.
Well,
do you have any comment about that? I mean, he wrote to the Department of Defense. He wrote to the governor of Kentucky. He's in the Kentucky National Guard. He wrote to his congressman, and no one has replied.
Is that something you can talk about, Professor McDermott?
Well, I have several responses. First of all, thank you very much for your call. And it's ironic that it happened to be Toronto because I grew up not very far away from there. So I have many responses to this question. First of all, there's a good news story there, which is that he got a follow-up call. And I'm actually very glad to hear that because I've been trying to pay very close attention to the degree to which DOD has been following up on Guard and Reserve members when they report things on the PDHRA. So first and foremost, I'm glad he got the call, and I hope if he needed help, he got the help he needed. Now, in terms of the issue...
He's more enraged that this was outsourced to a foreign country than any of the personal questions that were asked of him.
Sure. And I understand that, and I sympathize. I can only assume that, or hope, that when a contract like that was signed, that all of the necessary precautions were put into place. But it certainly is a very unusual arrangement to outsource something like that somewhere else. It is not unusual in the healthcare field, I think. I believe it's the case that here in Lafayette, there are radiologists reading our x-rays who are located in Australia, and I'm not necessarily any more happy about that than your son is. So
yeah,
I think he did the right thing to let people know how he feels about it, and hopefully there are enough providers here in the U.S. that service can be provided in-house.
Well, he wrote to, as I said, he wrote to several people, you know, and when we received this email from him that how outraged he was that this was being done. It was really quite traumatic for him.
Sure.
So thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I know that lots of the contractors that are working with the military, like Halliburton, that's not medical, but you know, those are global companies. So it probably is the case that a contractor who is based in the U.S. who would do those calls might have a call center in Toronto. But I completely understand the concern, and I think it's great that he raised it, and I hope someone responds. Mm.
Well, again, I guess that goes back to a point that we talked about earlier, that it seems that the Department of Defense is having a difficult time meeting the need. If they have to outsource this to something outside the Department of Defense, and then they have to outsource it to somebody outside of the United States, I guess that, again, just goes back to the idea that we have the need is great, and the system that we have in place to satisfy the need is not quite up to it yet.
There's a lot of work to do. The outsourcing piece is not just an artifact of this war. I mean, there's been a move, I think, for quite a while in Congress to encourage the Department of Defense to outsource more services. The theory is that it's very expensive to maintain someone in uniform, and that it's cheaper, just like it's considered to be cheaper in the civilian world, to hire a contractor. You get a temporary worker in when you need to plus up your workforce to meet a specific demand. And, you know, that's what Halliburton does and all these others. It's not a surprise that it would happen in the healthcare field. But there's a lot of work to do, and obviously lots of folks are being brought in to do it.
Let's talk next with somebody here in Champaign County, where we are, line number 3. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the opportunity to try to clarify in my mind the construct of post-traumatic stress syndrome. It seems to me that it is too narrow, and that perhaps those behaviors that the military and others consider to be healthy behaviors are really symptomatic of a post-traumatic survivor syndrome, that those people who re-enlist are considered to be valuable to the military, but maybe they are subject to guilt feelings about having survived, having not been wounded, having left their comrades behind. And that, too, might be a type of mental illness that we don't take into account. I'll hang up and listen to a response.
All right.
Thank you for your call. Again, I have to give truth in advertising that I'm not a clinician, but I'm happy to share my impression. First, I think you're very correct that it would be a mistake to give too much attention to PTSD in the realm of the whole range of mental health issues that military members experience, just like in the civilian population. There are substance abuse issues, there are depression issues, there are anxiety issues, there are personality disorders, and there's PTSD. So focusing too much on PTSD is a problem if it leads us to ignore other things that we should pay attention to. It's also true that steeling yourself to go into combat requires a certain kind of mental effort that in the course of daily life we don't have to do. And so some of the survival strategies that people might implement, I can see, might not be considered all that functional in daily life. One of the real struggles is when and how can you get a check of how military members are doing in terms of mental health? Data are gathered now very soon before people go on deployment. Generally, those data are considered to be suspect because people who really want to go on deployment, and there are many, will underreport issues, and people who don't want to go on deployment will overreport issues. The task force recommended that the military carry out an intention it had expressed earlier to conduct a periodic health assessment so that every year everyone would get a mental health checkup, just like they get a dental checkup, that we should spend as much attention monitoring the state of our brain as we do our jaw. And hopefully that would be an opportunity to pick up some of these things that you're talking about. It is difficult being a soldier, and people have to behave in certain ways to be successful at that. But hopefully, we can make sure that everyone who chooses that lifestyle has all the tools that they need to survive and thrive in doing it.
All right, let's continue. Our next caller is in Bloomington, Illinois. Somebody calling on, I guess we'll go to Chicago then, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you. Speaking of global matters, does your areas of interest extend to how soldiers and other issues relating to them are conducted in Europe and other parts of the world as far as their treatment and success or failure or whatever? Does it extend to those interests of those other areas? Could you comment
yes,
on that?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, go ahead.
The task force visited... made site visits in Europe and also in Asia. And through the course of my own research, I have visited Okinawa and several installations in Europe. In fact, I had the opportunity to go through reintegration training in Europe with soldiers who had just gotten off the plane from Iraq. So I've had a little bit of opportunity to learn about what they experience in terms of treatment and help. We did not make a site visit to Iraq, but we did try to interview people who had recently returned. And one of the innovations that the military has implemented, which I really applaud them for, is they're actually gathering data from military members during deployment about mental health matters and the degree to which folks feel like they're able to get access to mental health professionals when they feel they need it. And that's a really big job to gather those data, and I'm very happy that they're doing it.
See if we can get one more caller. Someone on the cell phone here, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question. You spoke about there being a number of providers who could assist our soldiers, not just psychologists. And going on the premise that support our troops is more than a bumper sticker, what can we do? What can the general public do? Are there volunteer opportunities? What can we do to support these people as they reintegrate into just the general population after service? How can we help?
What a great question. I was hoping someone would ask that question. The reality is that in every community around the country, there's probably someone who is experiencing deployment at this moment or has experienced it in the past. We have parents, partners, children, neighbors, friends, and others, and often we don't know. The challenges of deployment for family members are, of course, the stress. So if you know someone who could just use a shoulder to cry on or to get some reassurance, I think that's a great thing that you can do. In your communities, there are veteran service organizations like the Legion, and the Red Cross also works a lot with military families and the vet centers. You can go there and ask what you can do, and they'll know what the efforts in the local community are. Very often it's a wife who's left behind, and even when it's a husband, there are going to be certain things that happen that they don't know how to deal with, either some kind of household repair issue or a child behavior problem, or, you know, imagine a dad left at home with a daughter who hits puberty during deployment. There might be some questions where it might be nice to have someone they can ask. Same thing for a wife left at home. There are questions that they're going to need to ask. There are financial issues sometimes that happen, and so if you're an employer, you might want to pay attention to that. And I have heard such great stories from military members about how much it means to get care packages from people they don't know, even just letters saying thank you for your service, or little games or tokens that they can use to entertain themselves during, you know, the long periods of watching and waiting. So I so appreciate your question, and I hope that all of us will do what we can to support folks who are going through something very difficult for our country.
We're going to have to stop there. I want to thank the folks who called in. We've simply come to the end of the time. Our guest this morning, Shelley McDermid, is professor of family studies at Purdue University. She is also co-director of the Military Family Research Institute based at Purdue, and she was co-chair of the Department of Defense Task Force on Mental Health. They did release a report addressing this particular issue. It just came out in June of 2007, An Achievable Vision is what it's called. And if you're interested in reading more about this, you certainly can find that on the web. You can read a summary, or you can read the full report. And Professor McDermid, thank you very much for talking with us.
You are so welcome.
I also want to say thanks to the folks there on the other end of the connection, our ISDN connection there with the campus of Purdue.